The next case is 05-247, Clayton B. Smith versus Craig Conley. Mr. Mash.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Court. My name is Cliff Mash, and I represent the appellant in this case, Attorney Craig Conley. At this time, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my argument time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there on the clock.
Your Honors, while this case has a rather long and torturous history, the issue as it relates to this Court's review of this case is rather narrow, and the body of facts that I would submit are relevant to that issue are rather narrow as well. This Court accepted jurisdiction on the case on the sole argument as to whether or not the termination of the attorney-client relationship requires the filing of a motion to withdraw. As this Court is well aware, the case law dealing with the statute of limitations in a legal malpractice case has been adopted largely from medical malpractice case law. And by virtue of a number of this Court's decisions, this Court has reached the determination in the Skidmore case, the Omni Food case, and the Zumi case that in applying a statute of limitations analysis to a legal malpractice case, you have a two-prong test that you look at in order to reach that conclusion. The first prong deals with whether or not you have a cognizable event, which would give sufficient knowledge to the client as to the occurrence of malpractice. And the second separate prong of that deals with the termination of the relation for attorney-client for a particular transaction.
Counsel?
Yes.
I think we have a very different factual setting here from medical malpractice, in that, in this case, if I'm correct, this person, Mr. Smith, had not yet been sentenced. So his case had not yet terminated in the court itself, correct?
That is, he was not yet been sentenced. That is correct, Your Honor.
And your court rule does not allow an attorney to withdraw without court permission while a case is in progress, does it not?
Well, actually, the court ruled that the termination wouldn't trigger until the filing of a motion to withdraw, not whether or not the court granted the motion to withdraw.
What would happen if the court decided not to grant it?
Well, interestingly enough, in this case, the motion to withdraw was filed on September 6th of 2002. That's when the actual motion to withdraw was filed. The court didn't grant that motion until April 11th of 2005. So that motion basically remained in perpetuity before the court actually came around to rule on it.
But in essence, if the court has not permitted the attorney to withdraw, doesn't the court still consider that attorney counsel of record?
Well, you know, Your Honor, I think you addressed really the real issue in focus in this case. And I would submit to you that the analysis of the termination rule really has nothing to do with whether or not an attorney is an attorney of record in a court, whether or not an attorney has complied with any specific local rules. The analysis of the term—
I would agree with you if we were talking about the trial's terminated, you know, the sentence has been had, and now you're talking about appeals or further representation. You've got a conclusion to the case. But in a criminal setting, you have the right to counsel. You've been assigned. Was this assigned counsel or hired?
This was hired counsel, Your Honor.
Yeah, hired counsel. The court says that's your counsel until I say you no longer are counsel because you have to file a motion and I have to grant it. So under the court rule, he's technically still his attorney, And that's a very different scenario than somebody who doesn't have rights to counsel and all of those principles in a civil case. So is it, should we draw a different rule when a case is under active, still active status versus, you know, applying the general rule once a case is terminated and sentence has been had?
I don't think this court should apply any different rule in an analysis of a statute of limitations trigger from a civil case to a criminal case.
Wouldn't that be a clear rule, a simple rule? You know, when that attorney-client relation ends is when the court says motion granted.
Would there be some simplicity to that rule? I couldn't dispute the fact that there may be. But would that rule encapsulate what the purpose of the trigger of the termination rule is? No, it would not. And would that rule generate further problems? I submit it would. Your Honor, when we're dealing with the statute of limitations, the relevant issue has nothing to do with constitutional right to counsel. The relevant issue is, when does the consensual, mutually consensual relationship between an attorney and a client end for purposes of determining when what triggers this, the running of the one-year statute of limitations? Now, I don't think anybody would disagree with the fact that, you know, that an attorney and a client, there is a consensual mutual relationship, and that relationship can end by an affirmative act by either of the parties to that relationship, signaling that they don't want that relationship to continue. That's and the application of the trigger on the termination rule is in a civil action for legal malpractice, which is what we're here about today. We're not here about constitutional rights to an attorney at trial. Those are matters which were raised by Mr. Smith in appeal on his criminal case. We are here today with whether or not Mr. Smith brought his legal malpractice claim against his attorney within the one-year statute of limitation.
One of your trigger events, you claim, is that he filed his own pro se motion, correct?
I would submit that is indicia. That is information that we can look at from the record to discern that there has been a mutual decision to sever the attorney-client relationship.
And
that's
if a
correct.
Court says, I'm rejecting your motion because you can't file a pro se, you're represented by counsel, then what do we do with that?
Well, again, if we're looking at the proper focus, which should be, when does that relationship terminate for purposes of determining when a malpractice action may accrue?
When do you think it terminated in this case?
In this case, I think it terminates August 26th. At that point in time, Attorney Connolly sends a letter to Mr. Smith, and in that letter articulates very clearly that they have substantial differences in how the trial went forth.
But that letter said he would initiate a formal motion to withdraw. So it would indicate that, you know, we've got this problem, Ben, and if it's not resolved, I am going to do something to withdraw in the future.
Well, I would respectfully submit, Your Honor, if you read the entire letter, what the letter says, the letter says that I will not represent you at the sentencing hearing. I will not represent you for purposes of the motion for a new trial or for appeal. And I'm going to give you time to get an attorney to come in and file a substitution of counsel. If you don't do that, then I will file a motion to withdraw. And he tells Mr. Smith, the reason why I'm giving you—
But saying that he will do it in the future would imply that he's still counsel at present.
Well,
because those contingent events haven't yet occurred, and he sends him a second letter and repeats that if the successor counsel does not file a notice, then I will. So again, there's another predicate that doesn't occur.
And counsel, doesn't matter whether the court understands what the relationship is or isn't the focus on what the relationship is between the client and the attorney. And here, there was a clear understanding telegraph to the client, I'm no longer your attorney. So whether the court sanctioned that or understood it for the purposes of when is that attorney-client relationship triggered and the malpractice timeline starting, there are two different things here.
And, Your Honor, I would agree with you 100%. That is precisely the point. In Omni Foods, when this court formally adopted the application of the termination rule for malpractice, it said the focus isn't on the relationship between the attorney and the client. we're going to look at that relationship, and we're going to see when that relationship between those parties in a consensual relationship may be deemed to have severed, when there's mutual. That's the proper focus.
But even if you accept that, can you go back then and answer Justice O'Donnell's question when he says, I will withdraw when A or B happens? You have the attorney himself setting up the contingencies that set that exact time, and neither of those things had happened. Even though he says they may not want to represent you anymore, but I will do this, or your attorney will file this, and that will. I mean, that's what the letter seems to say. That's when the client relationship will end, when one of these two things happens. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is, number one, I think the letter unequivocally indicates that there's a severance of the relationship. He says, I won't represent you anymore. Mm-hmm. You have questioned what would happen in a trial. I question you what you want me to do in the future. I'm not going to do it. He tells Mr. Smith that I'm going to give you time to get an attorney to file a substitution. If you don't do that, then I'll file a motion for withdrawal. He goes, in the letter, he says, I would rather not have to explain to the court why I'm going to file a motion to withdraw, because he saw that as being not in the best interest of his client. And that's why he gave Mr. Smith the opportunity to come forward with counsel to protect him at the sentencing hearing. In the second letter and in the September 3rd letter, we see a memorialization again of conversations, especially the September 3rd letter, where Mr. Connolly indicates, we've had conversations. You now have told me you're going to file the motion pro se. I advise against that, but if you're going to do that, and he again advises him as to the relevant times. In all due respect, I think Mr. Connolly went above and beyond what an attorney should do in order to represent the interests of his client. He recognized the conflict. He recognized that he could not continue to represent this client. He told the client to get a new attorney. He told the client that he would hold off filing the motion withdrawal to give him time to get the attorney to file a substitution so he wouldn't have to explain to the court the reasons for the motion to withdraw. And I would respectfully submit that in focusing in on, the relationship between the attorney and the client, if this court looks at the October 26th letter, looks at the October 28th letter and the September 3rd letter, it can only come to the conclusion that there is a mutual dissolving of the relationship between the parties. And finally, we see that Mr. Smith on September 3rd does, in fact, file a pro se motion for a new trial. So now we have evidence on the other side of the equation by the client himself indicating that he is not going to go forward and allow Mr. Smith to represent him anymore. He's going to go pro se. Mm-hmm. All these issues dealing with, constitutionality of having counsel at the sentencing hearing, number one, is not before this court because it didn't accept that proposition. But more importantly, those are issues that are relevant and should be addressed in the context of the criminal appeal.
Mr. Mash, tell me again, or tell us again, if you would, you touched on it, but why should there not be a different rule in a criminal case than there is in a civil case? A criminal case, oftentimes, the client and the attorney may have a fairly brief relationship. There may not be the opportunity to have discourse and correspondence back and forth as there is in a civil case, where they tend to last longer and there's more correspondence and communication. Why should there not be a different rule for a criminal case than there is for a civil case?
Well, this court in the Kahn versus Kinley case rejected the argument that there should be a difference of elements of proof between representation in a civil case and a criminal case. And the reason the court reached that conclusion is that the obligations between a lawyer and a client are one and the same, whether you're dealing with a civil matter and a criminal matter, and the underlying relationship between the client and the attorney in those relationships are one and the same. And so this court has never treated those circumstances differently. And based on all the case law that's been cited in our brief, the focus by the substantial majority of all the appellate courts has been to look to the relationship between the attorney and the client and look at evidence as to when there's a conduct by one or the other or both that relationship has been dissolved, such as would trigger the termination rule for purposes of determining the statute of limitations. I see that I've used up my time, and I don't want to use up my rebuttal time, so I will rest at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Mash. Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. I am Clayton B. Smith, the actual Smith and Smith B. Conley. Pro se representation is a vital part of our justice system. I submit.
Mr. Smith, let me read one sentence from the August 26, 2002 letter to you from Mr. Conley. In short, we simply cannot and will not continue to represent you, period. What did that mean to you?
It meant that when I got the letter from Mr. Conley on the 26th, and we'll go into a little background because there's previous letters. What's in the record is a 26th letter, a 28th letter, and a September 3rd letter. I get a letter from Mr. Conley on the day after the trial saying, thank you so much for saying what a great job we did. We're sorry we didn't get the acquittal for you. Hopefully we can convince Judge Haas not to put you in prison. One day after the trial, new evidence comes up in the form of stop payments. The stop payments, and this is the vital part of this whole thing, and this is where this argument comes from. The stop payments were not brought into trial. They needed to be brought in as part of the record. So on the 28th or the 26th, 27th, in that time period, I had a set of stop payments faxed to Mr. Conley, had a set of stop payments faxed to Mr. Cypersky, who was co-counsel, and also one to the Canton Repository. The reason the relationship broke down on the 28th is once Mr. Conley realized that we had stop payments in place, it was a whole different situation. Now, instead of saying, well, let's go back in and we'll get this taken care of.
I had a simple question. What does that sentence mean to you?
The sentence in that he will not represent me until that date, as of that date. I will no longer represent you as that date.
All right.
Then he says, I will file a motion to withdraw on the September 10th. But also, after he makes
that statement. And he explains to you that the reason he's waiting is to let you have new counsel file something with the judge so that he doesn't have to go in and explain to the judge why they're withdrawing, because that would presumably be detrimental to your interests.
Well, it was not detrimental to my interests. It was detrimental to his interests. He was the one who had just discovered that because of the newly discovered evidence, there was a problem. I had no idea there was a problem until afterwards. The letter clearly states that I will not represent you. By September the 10th, I will file a motion to withdraw if you do not find substitute counsel or if you do not file your own motion pro se.
But that's what you did. You filed a pro se motion.
Exactly.
So that the contingency did, in fact, come to pass.
Except for in the state of Ohio.
He was out. Pardon me?
In the state of Ohio, we do not accept hybrid representation. In other words, for me to become my own pro se attorney, there would have to be a dialogue with the court saying,
wait a
minute. I no longer
did you file a pro se motion, and did you appear pro se at your sentencing hearing?
I appeared pro se at the motion for new trial on the 10th, and I appeared pro se at the sentence hearing.
And you filed a pro se motion for a new trial.
And I filed on September the 3rd, I filed.
You did all that.
That's right.
After you got the letter that said they're not going to represent you.
And that's the reason why I did it. Mr. Conley informed me that I had 14 days to file a motion for new trial based on newly discovered evidence. But when I filed the motion for new trial, under the local rule 1705D, the only way that Mr. Conley can get out of this representation is to go forward in front of the court, file a motion to withdraw with me being present and having it being ruled on.
So in answer to Justice Pfeiffer's question, when he said we are no longer going to represent you, that didn't mean anything legally, in your view.
In my view, it meant nothing.
But despite the fact that it meant nothing to you, you appeared twice in court pro se after you got that.
Exactly.
Without him, by yourself.
Right.
Well, counsel, when did it stop? When did it mean nothing to you? When you read it, you obviously thought, I don't have an attorney anymore. Isn't that right?
That's exactly what I thought.
Okay. So you thought, Mr. Conley no longer represents me. I better do something to protect myself.
Well, the reason I did something to protect myself is because it was my understanding the only way we were going to get these stop payments on the record is if they became part of the record.
Well, I understand that, but you took matters into your own hand because you no longer had an attorney.
Correct.
And then subsequently, when you filed all the malpractice action, that's when you started putting two and two together and figuring, well, gee, maybe he really was my attorney because he didn't comport with a rule of court.
Well, I didn't realize that he hadn't comported with a rule of court till way down the road.
Okay. And that's when you decided that, well, he was still my attorney back then, even though I said he, in my mind, he wasn't my attorney because I filed my own paperwork.
Well, that's exactly what I thought.
So your understanding, for the record, is that when you received that letter from Mr. Conley, that you no longer had an attorney-client relationship with him?
For that matter.
Okay.
And so I did not know that he was not going to be there for September 25th sentence hearing, because if you go back to what his letter says, we no longer represent you. You may get substitute counsel for your September 25th sentence hearing.
Or show up yourself, do pro se.
But I can't go pro se at a sentence hearing. I can file a motion pro se, but I could not go pro se to the sentence hearing.
Because he was still
your... I think this Court's already decided in Martin that there's no hybrid representation.
Because he was still your counsel of record.
He was always my counsel of record. The only way he became, and under Local Rule 1705D, which is a good rule, it says 30 days before trial, an attorney is your attorney. He can't write you a letter. He can't walk away from the case without going before the court. And the reason being is because 1705D protects my constitutional right to the guaranteed representation. So, am I guaranteed to that counsel? That's where the question comes before the court.
So what we have here is a factual situation, but we as a court have to decide what the law is as it applies to that. Is the fact that you two had a breakdown in your relationship and you believed he was no longer representing you control, or does the legal formal withdrawal by court order control? And that's a factual, that's a legal issue we need to resolve.
Well, the legal issue is very simple. He still represented me until that motion was ruled upon. And the Fifth District Court of Appeals ruled that that motion was on September 6th. Now, that motion stayed unruled upon for 2 years. I had filed a writ in prosciendo to have the judge go back and rule upon it, which he did on April 11th. So on April 11th of this year, that motion was finally ruled upon.
So Mr. Conley's been your attorney until April 11th of this year. Is that right?
The motion to withdraw was ruled upon on April 11th of this year.
So he has been your attorney until April 11th of this year.
If the only way that he can get out is to withdraw with a motion to withdraw and have it ruled upon, yes.
And that's the question that we have to answer.
Okay. But I would
the
say...
Rule, the rule seems to be in conflict with the test we would apply generally to when the attorney-client relationship has ended, and that's our problem.
But I would say that if you go by the rule...
The judge here, by delaying his or her action on the motion, can essentially force an attorney to maintain or stay in the attorney-client relationship, even though the attorney says, I'm out of it. I'm no longer represented. That puts the attorney in a bit of a bad situation, doesn't it?
Well, I would say it was in the attorney's behalf to go before the judge and say, well, why aren't we ruling on this motion for 2 years? If I was an attorney and I had a motion pending before a judge, I would say, Your Honor, this has gone on a little long. Can we rule on this? Can, you know, either nay or yay? My understanding from court rules is a motion's not ruled upon, it's considered not ruled upon. That was my understanding. But back to what we have here, Smith v. Conley stands for is we're upholding the local rule 1705D. 1705D mandates, it has the word shall. An attorney shall file a motion, and if he wants out of that situation, there's a way out. It's 30 days before the trial, okay? If we become a week before trial and he wants out, he simply can't write me a letter and say, I don't represent you anymore, because the court doesn't recognize that letter.
Counsel, could you have fired him?
Could I have fired him?
Yeah.
Yes, but I didn't.
Well, all right, let me just follow here. Could you have fired him and refused to allow him to attend a hearing with you?
I could have done that, but the judge would have had to make that decision.
And then if the judge told you you can't fire him, would that obligate you to keep this man as your attorney and pay him?
Well, of course it would, because of Criminal Rule 44C. The only way out is with, you know, the court has to make sure that I'm represented in a criminal matter. The only arguments that we have here...
He was not an appointed counsel to you.
No, he was a hired attorney.
You hired him. Okay.
I paid him good money to represent me. Everything was fine.
But if you don't meet the criteria for indigent representation, where the court's going to appoint somebody to represent you, it's your responsibility to get an attorney.
It's my responsibility to get an attorney. But the only way I can discharge that attorney 30 days prior to that trial is an open court.
Well, you could have hired another attorney and have that attorney present a notice of appearance.
And if that attorney filed a notice of appearance, then Mr. Connolly's job was finished. Until that.
But you never got another attorney.
I never got another attorney. I didn't think I needed one. I was under.
You thought you could do it yourself.
Well, I was under the impression.
And it didn't work out, right?
That Mr. Connolly was going to be there at the September 25th sentence
hearing.
That's
not.
I had no idea.
That's not. Sir, that's not what you said originally. You said as of the date you got the September 28th letter, you thought he was no longer your attorney, and you then proceeded to handle it yourself.
Well, if we look at the September 3rd letter, and I respectfully disagree with you on that, on the September 3rd letter, it states that we are aware that you do not have counsel, and we will not be representing you in the appellate process. It doesn't say anything about September 25th. He'd already got assignment notice. The assignment notice was sent to him to be there. Now, back to the concept. The difference between what the opposing side is saying here is there is a big difference between criminal representation and civil representation. In a criminal matter, you can write a letter. There's case laws that state that you can do that. Wozniak. The letter basically said, the guy told him at trial, we don't represent you anymore. So he walked away and said, okay, that's fine. But in this matter, when Attorney Connolly said to Clayton Smith, I do not represent you anymore, in a letter, in a telephone call, or formally, he cannot withdraw until he files a formal motion.
I would think Clayton Smith would want Mr. Connolly to represent him after those letters.
Well, there's a difference.
That's not the issue, but
the
side of it is most people wouldn't want. You'd say, fine, I don't want you any longer if you get a letter like that.
But on the other hand, as I can speak from this because I just paid this man $5,000 to represent me. Yeah. Now I don't know what's happening. And most defendants, you're in a trial for a day. You don't know what's going on in that trial. Before you know it, the whole thing's over, and we've got a verdict. I don't know why we lost the trial. Then in our situation, when new evidence came forward, it was up to him to present that evidence. It was not my place to do it. The only reason I rushed in, not knowing what I was doing, is because I thought I needed to preserve the record. Now, here's exactly the difference between criminal representation and civil representation.
Well, you must have thought also that he really wouldn't be there after those letters, didn't you?
Well, did I know that he wouldn't be there?
Well, you must have at least had some inkling that he might not show up after those letters.
Well, actually, I don't even want to go into that because he was there on September 10th because I had a conversation in the hall with him. But on September 3rd, when he's advising me not to go forward, he's still giving me legal advice on September 3rd. This is still legal advice from an attorney and a client. But back to the point here, and this is what has to be made clear. I understand how a letter can discharge the relationship in a civil matter. That's fine. But in a criminal matter, because of the constitutional right of a criminal defendant, he must be made aware that, hey, if you go forward, you know, something bad could happen to you here. In other words, exactly, and I would be the perfect example to explain that. On September 10th, I go in and I do a motion for new trial. I bring in the stop payments. I say, Your Honor, there's been a big mistake here. Here's my stop payments. I can't be convicted under 29-13-11. He goes, okay, fine. Motion not well taken. I did not authenticate the documents, okay? Had I been an attorney, had I known that, hey, you go down to the bank, you get a certification, you authenticate those documents, you go forward. I damaged myself because I gave up my right to an attorney.
Did the judge ever ask you where your attorney was?
Never asked. There was never any conversation between the judge and myself. Hey, do you give up this right? Do you know what you're doing? Did I voluntarily waive it? Did I knowingly waive it? And, of course, you know, intelligently,
Mr. Smith, you allude to these documents as if they were a slam dunk, you win the trial. It seems to me embedded in the letter from Mr. Connolly is plenty of reason to wonder about the authenticity and everything else about these so-called exonerating documents. So,
well, what Mr. Connolly said in the letter is we have no good reason for not having those letters, those stop payments. We have no good reason.
He went into a lot of detail.
No good reason. not where they came from. But the bottom line is, and this is where, you know, a motion for new trial is pretty important. The bottom line is, did they exist before the trial? The answer is yes. Did we have them at trial? The answer is no. Could we use them for the motion in new trial? The answer is no. And if you read into what the Fifth District Court of Appeals stated, due diligence. Did you go forward and try to get these before the trial? You knew they were there, but did you go forward and try to get it? And that's where the whole thing comes up. We could have gotten them. Had my attorney subpoenaed those, they would have been there. I would have never been convicted. Did I need to get them on the record? I felt I did. Should I have been told that, hey, you can't go forward unless you know what you're doing? That's why FREDA is so important. That's why that criminal rule 44C, it has to be done in open court. Back to the letter.
You've used your time. Mr. Smith, you've used your time.
Can I say one more thing?
One more thought.
Okay.
30 seconds.
Back to the letter. Okay. If a letter can communicate the dissolving of an attorney-client relationship, it has to go to the judge. The only way, there's three people in a criminal matter. There's the judge, there's the attorney, and there's the client. The only way you dissolve that relationship 30 days prior to the trial with Local Rule 1705, it has to be ruled upon. How can you send a letter to a judge if you don't send it in the form of a motion? It would be an ex parte communication if it wasn't a motion. So the only proper way in a criminal matter is that the motion has to be filed, it has to go before the judge, and the judge has to say, you don't represent him anymore.
Thank you,
it can't
Smith.
Be done independently of the court.
Thank you. Mr. Mash, you've saved a minute and a half of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. Your Honor, it comes right down to it. What are the downsides? What's the problem with adopting a rule that's been proposed by the Fifth District Court of Appeals being the relationship isn't terminated until you get a filing of a motion to withdraw? Number one, it is not the true accurate measure as to when the relationship dissolved. We see by the evidence in this case that there was a mutual decision between both parties that happened well before the filing of the motion to withdraw that exemplifies that the relationship on both ends of the equation was no longer mutually confident and had dissolved. Number two, the rule I would submit goes against the underlying justification for this court's deciding to apply a termination rule in legal malpractice. In the Omni Foods case, the court looked at the justification in Med-Mal cases and it said, well, implementation of this rule to legal malpractice will encourage the parties to resolve their disputes without litigation and stimulate lawyers to mitigate against their clients' damages. If this court is going to adopt a rule that in order for a lawyer to protect himself from a potential malpractice claim, when he gets clear communication of dissatisfaction from the client, the lawyer is going to immediately file a motion to withdraw to protect himself. You know, a hope of creating a mutual relationship to avoid further litigation is going to go away because lawyers, whenever they hear their clients articulate dissatisfaction, in order to protect themselves from a malpractice claim and limit that box of time to file a malpractice action, are going to be encouraged to file motions to withdraw sooner rather than later.
Counsel,
your client could have done that earlier, couldn't he? He could have just said, we're going to file this morning to withdraw. And instead he said, we're going to do it in 3 weeks.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And the reason that he didn't is in the record is that he wanted his client to have the opportunity to do it so he wouldn't have to explain it to the court.
Thank you.
And counsel, isn't Local Rule 1705D actually a simple procedural rule for that particular court wanting to know who the attorney of record is? And that if there's going to be a change, then you do this 30 days before trial. It really has nothing to do with termination or the breakdown of the attorney-client relationship.
I absolutely agree, Your Honor. It gives no insight to when the actual relationship breaks apart. Lastly, the problem with adopting this rule, what happens in the situation where you have here, where you had the motion to withdraw being filed on September 6th, that motion did not get granted for 2 years later. That motion didn't get granted until after he filed his malpractice action.
Mr. Smith says that Mr. Connolly could have urged the court to remind the court that you got this motion pending here for two. It's the court's rule, and yet the court sits on the motion.
And it puts the lawyer at the mercy of when the court actually rules on the motion.
Yeah, it sure does.
And it takes focus away from the true crucial evidence as to when the relationship dissolved, which is what I respectfully submit should be the rule that is applied in a criminal as well as civil cases. And on that basis, I would respectfully request that this court overturn the decision by the Fifth District Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Mash. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.